Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode. Indeed, a new week here at the Damage Report under lockdown. And it being Monday, I thought, why not make it fantastic? Here's Franfio. How's it going? Francesca Fiorentini, glad
What's
to have
up?
You back.
Happy Monday.
I'm very glad to have you here. You know how, like, everyone is, like, everyone's using Zoom and stuff like that now a lot more? And
heard
like
of this.
In line with that going up, people complaining about being on those sorts of calls is going up too. They should like Skype in people to a web show they do, because that's enjoyable. Like, we were talking before the show and I loved it. You know, that's the sort of video chat I want.
Subject everyone else to our jobs.
Exactly. Yeah. The subjecting we're going to be doing today is a little bit of it's, you know, kind of dark, a little bit worried about what's going to happen in the near future, considering what's been happening in the recent past. We do have some sad news in the comedy world, which came as a shock to Francesca, who had not been aware of it. But we're going to get to that in just a minute. We're going to continue our we're just talking a lot about meatpacking plants these days. So we're going to do more of that. And then a pretty important update in the Ahmaud Arbery case that will be completely ignored by the right-wing media that is doing everything it can to demonize yet another victim of violence in America. So that should be fun. Anyway, if you're already here in the chat, as many of you apparently are, feel free to hit that like button so that more people know that the show is going on. You can chat along in the comments on Twitch. You can tweet us at hashtag TDRLive. You can also send in super chats, and we're going to be responding to some of those as they come in. Not 100% sure if I'm supposed to plug this. I'm going to be very vague. But Francesca, the thing we were talking about, is that a thing that you are promoting?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Feel free.
Oh, yeah. So my podcast, which John Iderola has been on, The Bituation Room, is coming back. We're coming back live this Sunday at 6 p.m. and every Sunday from here into eternity. So it'll be on Twitch, YouTube, Facebook, and you guys can just, it'll be like The Damage Report, but not with John all the time. Anyway, it's also funny. Just, yeah.
That'll, it is. You get funny people, you get funny, smart people together, and you have fun. I had a lot of fun on the episode that I did.
Yeah, you were great.
Which now feels like a million billion years ago.
Oh, it was. Twas. I was, quite a long time ago.
So when you told me this, I told you, I just was recently going back over some of the iTunes listing of episodes, and I hadn't realized how long of a run you'd already had on the podcast. In my mind, it was like you started it in like mid-2019. But no, it's been going for a while.
Not before 2019. It was 25 episodes plus of 5 or so lives. Well, like 28.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I got hammered by the Tulsi crowd when I called an episode Tulsi Kool-Aid.
I didn't see that one.
I think they drank their own Kool-Aid in the end. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are shows for everyone.
Shout out to all the Tulsi fans.
There you go. Okay, so we are going to be breaking down the news. This is all our live show. Stay tuned. Watch the whole thing. But as I always say, we also do interviews that we put up on the TDR YouTube channel separately, including today, after the show, I'm going to be interviewing Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate for the presidency. So that's not going to be live, but we are going to be filming it and uploading it. And so check back a little bit later if you're not already subscribed to the channel. That would be a great idea. Do whatever you want to the bell to get notifications. That's my advice to you.
Intentionally.
Exactly. Ask the bell. With that, why don't we jump into the news, where we're unfortunately going to be starting on something pretty sad. One of the longtime icons of comedy in America, Jerry Stiller, apparently passed. That was announced earlier this morning. I saw it on Twitter. His son, Ben Stiller, tweeting, "I'm sad to say that my father, Jerry Stiller, passed away from natural causes. He was a great dad and grandfather and the most dedicated husband to Anne for about 62 years. He will be greatly missed. Love you, Dad. And a just great classic photo of Jerry Stiller there. By the time I saw this, many people, you know, pretty much everybody in comedy and everyone famous was, you know, paying their condolences to this, you know, like Titanic figure, especially recently, like found so much success in the latter portion of his life. I know, Francesca, you found out about this just as we were about to go live. So what are your thoughts?
I think what I said at the time was, no, but 92, he had an amazing life, clearly gave birth to Ben Stiller, maybe other children. I don't know. I don't think he personally gave birth to them. The point is, he was there. And I just think there's nothing greater for a comic than to play such an iconic role as Seinfeld's dad, whose name, what was his name again?
And I am George Costanza's dad, Frank.
Or yeah, George Costanza. I need all my coffee.
Jerry Costanza. Seinfeld's dad was very good in that show as well.
But, oh, he was good. No. Yes, Costanza's dad complaining about feeling a draft in every restaurant he went into. Festivus. I mean, mm-hmm. God, Frank Costanza was so good. And so, like, I feel like that's a hugely successful career. And I mean, yeah, rest in peace. But man, how much do we all go back and watch Seinfeld? I do.
I still watch it often.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the shows that I'm always, you know, just jumping into a season. Doesn't even really matter where you start. I like, some people don't like the last couple seasons. I still like those. It was getting real wacky, but I was down for it. Yeah, and he was 92 years old. It's got to be, you know, devastating for his family, including Ben Stiller right now. I mean, that they had him for so long, and it's already a really stressful time. There's no indication that I've seen that it has anything to do with what's going on. He was 92 years old, passed, had lost his wife, I believe, in 2015. They had been married for 62 years. And I'm familiar now with his career. Like, in the past, I was a big fan of his, so I read up on, you know, like, how he sort of got into comedy. And, like, he and his wife had this, like, live comedy show that they would do back in the 60s, where they would joke about how different they are and everything. And it's just so crazy that, like he started way back then and could have never imagined, no, he's going to be this, like, huge pop culture figure decades later for a role that he did for a comic that hadn't even been born yet at that point. So gosh, just amazing.
I want to watch that. Now I want to just go back and watch old Jerry Stiller and his wife's stand-up routine.
Yeah. And so in terms of seeing his work, I wasn't a King of Queens fan. Like, I didn't really watch it. I can't say I'm not a fan because I didn't watch it, so I don't even know. But I loved him as Frank Costanza. And that's why I was shocked when I found out. I want to read this for you. He was in fewer than 30 of the 180 episodes. There's more, and I'll read it in a sec. I just, like, I felt like he was just throughout. And his first appearance wasn't until the fifth season. It felt like he was such a big part of it.
Whoa, that's crazier to me that he didn't appear until the fifth season.
What, were there only 8 or 9 seasons? He wasn't there for the first half. And obviously everybody knows there was a different actor who played George's father earlier, but he cast such a shadow over the show.
I want to know how many episodes Newman was in, because honestly, Frank Costanza greater than Newman any day of the week.
I'm going to find out, because I think it's 46. Newman was in more. Boo! I'm shocked to find that out. I do love Newman, though. He is great. And so if you're not familiar with the character, just give you an idea of who this character was. Frank Costanza was a classic sitcom eccentric whose many dubious accomplishments include marketing a brassiere for men and creating Festivus, a winter holiday for the rest of us, celebrated with tests of strength and other bizarre rituals. And, you know, just because today he's passed, I think we're going to have to rule in his favor on the classic debate about whether that brassiere should have been called the bro or the manzier. It's manzier all the way. We're going to give this one to Jerry Stiller.
Yeah.
Sad. Yeah.
So sad. Here's the other thing. I just really appreciate that he would, you know, be talking perfectly normally and then start to yell like this. I'm sorry, but that was the best part. Like, I think we all should all incorporate that into our lives now.
Mm-hmm. That he irrational anger.
Just irrational anger.
Yeah.
I already have, we all have that.
We do. We do. Yeah, but there's a moment, there's an episode where George is trying to be a bad boy and he tries like pirating a movie, like filming it in the theater. And at the end, Frank has to get him out of prison or whatever. And he and Frank and Elaine have this conflict. It's one of the greatest moments of the series. Look it up. But anyway, I did want to let you know about one other thing. It's going around on Twitter right now, but Jerry Stiller and his wife, Anna, back in 1994, participated in an ad campaign to promote, not like shoes or cereal or anything like that, but no, something much more worthwhile. Take a look at this.
What's wrong, honey?
I'm confused about Harry and Louise.
You mean that worried couple on the insurance company's commercials?
They're so confused about health care.
And you're confused because they're confused.
They keep saying there's got to be a better way.
There is. The single-payer system. Everyone is covered, you get full benefits, and you choose your own doctor.
Harry and Louise, there is a better way.
Yeah, that was back in 1994. Jerry Stiller was an ad for single-payer health care. How amazing
Such
is that?
A G. Oh my God. Such a G. Oh, that I'm going to, I feel like I'm going to get emotional now.
It's so sad.
Yeah, it's really sad. He, in 92, it's a perfectly fine age to, you know, peace out into the next lifetime. But, wow, we're going to miss him. And we need more, Jerry Stillers.
We do. We do. I mean, I guess we got Ben. He's good too.
Yeah. He's good.
No, I like Ben. I like Ben.
I know. I really do. I actually like him the best when he's directing and writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, and he's been in so many classic movies and everything. Not everything holds up, you know, perfectly well, but at the time, much appreciated. By the way, not to get the show even more down, considering we're going to be turning to sad news too, but every once in a while, this is going to be really depressing, but my wife, who acts and hosts and all that, we're very into movies. So like we take like watching the Oscars and the Golden Globes like super seriously and stuff like that. And, you know, they'll do those and they'll have like the lifetime achievement thing where they'll bring a person up and show everything they've done over their life and everything. And every single time I watch one of those, I get depressed, not for the obvious reasons, which are perfectly fine by themselves. But I think like it is going to feel like that before we're watching that in 40 years and it's like Scarlett Johansson's lifetime achievement thing, or like it's like an in memoriam and it's like we lost Kristen Stewart this year or something like that. Just
will not shed a single tear for okay. ScarJo.
Name whoever you want, whatever character, whatever actor you
will
want.
Will never. There are very few people I would shed a tear for in memoriam in 40 years. So, I mean,
you just don't like actors, basically.
No, but I do like your wife.
Thank you. Well, maybe, hopefully she won't be one of them. But anyway, yeah, that at some point it'll be like our cohort is like, God, it just, I don't like, it used to be enough to get depressed about the future, but now let's be real. The next couple of months are going to be tough enough by themselves.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Over the weekend, Donald Trump was asked about the fact that multiple close aides, both to himself and to Vice President Pence, have recently been tested positive for coronavirus. And in talking about it, he seemed to reveal that he has a difficult time understanding this whole getting sick thing and what it means and how it happens. Take a look.
Bring us up to speed about the member of the Vice President's staff who is now tested positive for coronavirus. This is now the second staffer in the West Wing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about it. Does anybody want to talk about it? She's a wonderful young woman. Katie, she tested very good for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden today she tested positive. She hasn't come into contact with me. She spent some time with the Vice President. I believe the press person, right? It's a press person. She tested positive out of the blue. This is why the whole concept of tests aren't necessarily great. The tests are perfect, but something can happen between a test where it's good and then something happens and all of a sudden she was tested very recently and tested negative. And then today, I guess, for some reason, she tested positive.
For some reason.
Serenity now. Serenity now.
Hoochie mama. negative, positive. I don't know what this is. He said, this is why the concept of testing isn't necessarily good. Because you can test negative, and then all of a sudden you test positive. What's that about? He said that, like, not in his internal monologue, not a stupid comment to Melania that she tried to pretend she was already asleep so she wouldn't have to respond to, as she does to most of his advances. No, he said it to a bunch of reporters that people go from testing negative to testing positive, and what's that about? That makes me think tests are bad. And this is fairly consequential because, remember, he has been increasingly attacking the concept of widespread testing worse and worse for weeks now, saying that it's not necessary to reopen, that we are in fact doing more testing than we actually need, that if states feel like they need more testing, that has nothing to do with him or the federal government. And now he says that if a test shows that you are positive for coronavirus, that is evidence that tests are bad.
I mean, yes, the tests are a Democratic plot against Trump 2020 re-election campaign. Like, that's what it is. Like, because if tests reveal that people are sick, then they clearly hate America and the economy. I mean, that's what his mind, this is the mental gymnastics that he is doing. Mm-hmm. I constantly am like, is he dumb? Is he senile? But I think when you're so convinced of your BS, You are, again, it's very easy to jump through all of these mental hoops. I love that he says out of the blue, out of the blue, something happened.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder what that something is. And I think to me, the part about all of this that is the most egregious is that so many Americans can't get access to tests and testing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And here he's testing every week his staff, which he should do. I'm not saying that. I think everyone should be able to test themselves ideally every week, right? With little hassle, no cost, et cetera. But it's almost like you're flaunting the idea that you're weekly testing people in the White House because apparently, of course, they're more precious than everybody else. And then when she tests positive, throw the whole test thing out.
Exactly.
We don't want them anymore. We'll give them to us then.
Yeah. And by the way, I see someone in the comments saying, well, you know, some of these tests have a false positive rate, which, of course, yes, every test for a virus is going to have some percentage of false positives that it's going to report. And it is entirely possible that Katie Miller, voluntary wife of Stephen Miller, that she had a false positive. If that is true, though, he has given us no indication of that, and that does not appear to be what he's saying in this video. He doesn't say she tested positive and then further follow-up tests show that it was a false positive. He does not say that. He says out of the blue she's positive, and then he just moves on to talking about other things. So, yes, we do have to worry about the possibility of false positives, but that does not appear to be what he is saying when he is so flabbergasted by the concept of someone testing positive for a virus.
I can't wait to do contact tracing in the White House and discover that Trump has been the super spreader infecting everyone.
I mean, it is possible. By the way, I know that he gets tested every week, and now people are saying he gets tested every day, but someone brought up, like, one of the tests, the swab tests, they stick a swab really far into your nasal cavity. If they did that to Trump once, do you think he's going to let them do it every day? A guy who, does he look like the sort of person that willingly experiences annoying or painful physical things?
Well, it's all, there's no more nerves up there because of all the Adderall that he snorts.
That's potentially true. Okay, so really fast. The consequences of this could, of course, be that if an aide close to Vice President Pence was positive, and if it turns out that it wasn't a false positive, that he could have coronavirus as well. And so the president wanted to reassure Americans that Mike Pence is taking this very seriously.
Mike knows about it, and Mike has done what he has to do. I think he is on an airplane going to some faraway place, but you'll be able to ask him later on. But they've taken all of the necessary precautions.
Okay, so there he says they have taken all of the necessary precautions. So I wanted to see what are these necessary precautions, and apparently as of this morning, Vice President Mike Pence is not planning to enter self-quarantine after his press secretary tested positive for coronavirus and plans to be at the White House on Monday. And we already know, not a big fan of wearing masks, Mike Pence, so all of those precautions, I don't know what those are. And by the way, I love him saying he's on a plane flying somewhere very far away.
Yeah, very, very far.
Are you a child in 1950? What are you talking about?
An aeroplane.
Yeah, anyway, so taking it seriously but not doing anything about it.
I mean, all of this, I mean, I don't really know what the end game is for them personally, right? Like, even Ted Cruz came out in a mask as he was, like, lauding his... the hairdresser who defied stay-at-home orders and, you know, like modeling his disgusting new haircut. But at least most of his face was covered. So that was like, you know, I could eat and watch it at the same time. But like, even he's wearing a face covering because he knows that he could potentially be infected and or infect someone else. I don't know, like, what are Trump and Pence? Are they just playing like a game of chicken and then the last one to get COVID, you know, is a wuss? Like, what's going on?
I don't know. But what I do know is that multiple people, obviously, we talked about at the end of last week, someone close to Trump, the valet, and now the press secretary for Pence have tested positive for it. And they say that, you know, they're getting tested now every day as a precaution. But and some people around Trump now, Secret Service is wearing masks. I would have thought that they would have been before. But when they say these things about the precautions they're taking, how seriously they're taking it, I don't. Why would we trust them? Like, he always says that he wasn't near these people, even when photographic evidence comes out that he was. Like, he is so much more concerned about presenting this fake image of strength in the face of the disease that I wouldn't trust anything that he says about it. He doesn't take it seriously for us. I don't know that he is for
Trump
him.
Trump has ever washed his hands. Ever. Ever washed his hands. No, seriously. Wiped. He's wiped his hands.
Uh-huh.
Never washed.
You mean dry wiping?
Just wiping, pants, napkin, you know, McDonald's napkins, uh-huh. Goes through them, just like clear cuts a whole forest of McDonald's napkins.
It's been a while since we've had a vote in the chat. Vote one in the chat if you think Francesca's right and he's never washed his hands. Two, if you think every once in a while he cleans himself up a little bit. We know that long-term, the real solution to the pandemic that we're experiencing right now is a vaccine, with the problem being that it's going to take quite a while for one to be developed and tested and then eventually made available, hopefully at an affordable price. What does Trump think about this vaccine? You might be surprised.
So, but how important do you believe a vaccine is to getting out of this? And what do you say to those that you know, this growing anti-vaccine?
Well, I feel about vaccines like I feel about tests. This is going to go away without a vaccine. It's going to go away, and we're not going to see it again, hopefully, after a period of time. You may have some flare-ups, and I guess, you know, I would expect that. Sometime in the fall, you'll have flare-ups, maybe. Maybe not, but according to what a lot of people say, you probably will. We'll be able to put them out. But eventually, it's going to go away. The question is, will we need a vaccine? At some point, it will probably go away by itself. If we had a vaccine, that would be very helpful. Be very happy to have a vaccine.
That seems like a pretty significant change in stance to saying it would be helpful, but we don't need a vaccine. It will go away without a vaccine. And if it comes back, we'll stamp it out. And again, I don't know why reporters aren't asking a follow-up question. What the hell do you mean when you say stamp it out? There is no cure.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, and I think Trump, like all hacks, are whipped by their audience to a certain degree. And he knows that he is gaining steam within the online anti-vax community.
Yes.
And so, you know, he gets those reports. He understands which Reddits and, you know, which Breitbart articles and which, you know, weird YouTube channels are boosting him, and are proud that he's not taking it super seriously. Maybe it's because they don't believe in vaccines. Maybe it's because they believe that the coronavirus is killing the right kind of people, primarily black and brown people, mm-hmm. undocumented immigrants, people in prison, people that they've been demonizing and have an ideology of hate against. And that's what Trump represents to them. So, it's very dangerous. Like, I think, yeah, he says at the end there, like, oh, yeah, you know, it would be nice to have a vaccine. I mean, that would be great. But that's still a win for me for in the mind of anti-vaxxers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you're right. He doesn't want to turn off the crazies. And he knows that there's a whole bunch of communities of interlinked but not necessarily 100% overlapping crazy people. There's the vaccine crazy people, the 5G crazy people, the, you know, whatever. There's a lot of them. And the president of the United States wants those people to like him. And so he implies that a vaccine isn't necessary. Like, there are more and more people who are against all vaccines. But you would think, at least in this case, I mean, come on, 80,000 people have died. People are going to take the vaccine, right? But no, like there are right-wing personalities lining up to say, Candace Owens tweeted, no, I would never take a vaccine for coronavirus. These are popular people. Very popular people. And the president has a chance to say, no, obviously we need a vaccine. That is the solution to this problem. We're doing everything we can to get one, by the way. And that's the thing. Undercutting what he just said, he last week set up Operation Warp Speed to test and pass through all these potential vaccines as fast as possible. He's invoking Star Trek to say how important it is that we get this done quickly. But then in public, when asked about it, he says, you don't need one. No, it'd be nice, but no, we don't need one of those. Like, think about it. Is it just because of the vaccine people, or is it, I don't know if we're going to actually get one. We're certainly not going to get one, no matter what I say, before the election. And since I've been telling people we're going to be just fine, if more bad news comes out, that might hurt me. So now I'm trying to downplay the need for it. Like, there is no aspect of the solution of the pandemic that the right is not actively attacking right now, whether it's Absolutely. Testing, vaccine, social distancing, literally using masks, all of it.
And I all know it. it's, you know, I know this is sort of a ridiculous exercise, but we have to remember what the right-wing media would look like if there were a Democratic president. Just imagine, right, how much they would pummel. And rightly so, if a Democratic president, that's a nice Freudian slip, if a Democratic president were bungling this response to coronavirus as much as, you know, Trump is, they would hammer him or her, right? And so, like, again, back to the, like, well, if Obama were president right now, they would suddenly take it seriously, and just how partisan they're making it. It's frightening. Like, what, again, what is the end game here? And it truly is to radicalize the most fringe of the fringe of Americans to, and we've seen, take up arms and defy sheltered home orders, stick up for their president, etc.
Yeah. I want to read a quote. I forget exactly what article I pulled it from. But I read it over the weekend, and it seemed apt, so I'm going to read it. The plan is to have no plan, to let daily deaths between 1 and 3,000 become a normal thing, and then to create massive confusion about who is responsible. And I really do think it's as simple as that. I think that they figured out that it either would be too difficult to get the number of deaths down, or the solutions are just things they don't want to do. They don't want to extend the lockdowns and provide government aid so that the economy isn't decimated while that's going on. They just don't want to do that. And so the solution is let it run rampant and then just, you know, throw out enough, you know, 5G towers and Bill Gates and, you know, all this stuff and say something, cupboards were empty, whatever. maybe be mad, but not too mad, because the numbers are probably inflated. That many people aren't dying anyway. They're probably just making it up. But even if you do get mad, just be mad at, like, everybody, kind of. Like, a generalized mad. Not mad at the people who not only were in a position to protect you, but swore that only they could protect you. Mm-hmm. That seems to be what the plan is.
Trump is giving up, absolutely. He's the only president to withdraw from a war to ensure more casualties.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah, you said it. If nobody in the universe thinks that if this had hit in 2014 and Obama had presided over 80,000 people and counting dying, that Tucker Carlson would be like, you know what? I disagree with the president, but the important thing is that we get the economy going again. We just got to get back out there and be warriors. I stand with Obama. We're warriors. Who thinks that? There ain't no grifter paid well enough to admit that they think that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. No, and the real thing is, and I just want to say, like, and we've talked about this, but if you don't have mass testing, which we don't, if you don't have a vaccine, which we don't, what you need is for people to stay at home. And that means you need economic compensation. You need better unemployment benefits. You need more than a $1,200 one-time stimulus check. And you need more of that immediately and consistently. And I know there has been a bill, you know, introduced by Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris to give Americans $2,000 a month, which absolutely at the minimum we should all be receiving because of this. And I would, you know, I think it's fine to prioritize frontline workers or prioritize people who are out of work. Yes. But that's the thing. They're basically saying, no, we're not willing to do what it takes to support Americans in order for all of us to keep our lives.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. It's not that we have to sacrifice our lives to the economy. It's that you're not willing to sacrifice your tax breaks so that we have a fighting chance.
I just saw an interview with Senator Lamar Alexander, who was asked about, you know, the pressure on the federal government in its upcoming legislation to provide more aid to the people who've suffered economically during the pandemic and the lockdowns. And at least according to him, I would not get your hopes up.
There's not enough money to help everybody hurt when you shut down the government. So the only solution is test, trace, isolate, treatments, and vaccines. So the fast track on testing is the only solution to this. So we have to reopen the economy. We have to do it carefully. We have to let people go back to work and earn a living. And I don't see us being able to appropriate much more money to help provide a counter to that.
Okay. So, no, there's just not enough money. Like and by the way, he says the things that we should do, testing and contact tracing, all of that. Those are good. Yeah, do those. But in terms of more aid to the people, I hope that you saved, you know, some of that $1,200 that they gave you, because it's going to have to last for a bit, hypothetically.
I mean, this is the thing, though. It's like, y'all are need to gonna come up with a solution. And it, again, if you don't have tests and you don't have a vaccine, then guess what, homies? You're going to have to provide more money. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to provide it to people. So, like, once again, Carnival Cruises back on. They're going to open in August. They've got great rates, you know, and people are buying tickets. I don't know why, but, like, businesses are getting bailouts. You know, medium-sized businesses to large business corporations that didn't even need it. And word on the street from the next bailout package or the next stimulus package, that's going to include tax breaks, because of course Republicans are going to try, as they already have done with the last few rounds of stimulus budgets, to make as much money for themselves and to their shareholders and to, you know, millionaires who have increased their wealth in these months.
Yeah, 100%. Has Lamar Alexander ever said there's just not enough money for the military or for tax cuts or for, you know, like assisting businesses, for instance? After all, they handed trillions of dollars in stimulus to big businesses, super blasé. It was just casual. It took them like a week to put together a bill to hand over trillions of dollars. And they're like, ah, Steve Mnuchin will take care of the details. I trust that guy. But aid to the actual workers? No. And what makes it so insulting is it would be one thing if it was just we don't care about the workers. Like, we're just not interested. We're not going to help them. But it's, we're not interested in them. We're not going to help them. But at the same time, we're going to use pretend concern for their economic situation as the argument for why we need to forcibly send people back to work ASAP. That's right. What they do. They say it's because people are suffering and people have lost their jobs, so we have to reopen right now, even if the states that we're reopening haven't met even the White House's low threshold for dips in cases and all of that. We have to go back because people are suffering. What? Help the people? No, can't possibly do that. There's not money for that. That's what's so insulting about this, is that there is this fake dichotomy between staying shut down forever, opening up forcefully, as if the government can't get involved in helping people to get by an extended lockdown without losing their house, losing everything, basically going bankrupt, all of that. It's just fake. And I hate that the media has been complicit in helping to sustain that false dichotomy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's also a time, you know, whether Republicans like it or not, all of this is going to backfire on them, and Democrats too, right? Because I think workers are developing a lot of class consciousness right now. They understand that when they're being asked to go back to work and put their lives at risk, they're going back to make their bosses more money. They're going back to make millionaires more and more millions, billionaires more and more billions, okay? They're not just going back for themselves. I mean, these are people who've been asking for raises for years now. So what are we really talking about? So actually, I mean, I think they're politicizing the hell out of the working class. I don't think it's a good thing, right? But I think where we're headed could be something like a renewed labor movement, which I think is really necessary.
Yeah, 100%. A little bit more on this, because we are expecting that eventually Congress is going to come back into session and try to put together something. But again, hopes should probably be kept at a low level. Larry Kudlow, President Donald Trump's top economic advisor, said on Friday that formal negotiations with Congress over the next COVID-19 stimulus package have been suspended, even as other White House officials predict the U.S. unemployment rate could surpass 20% by next month. One of the reasons that that probably hasn't deterred them from suspending the negotiations is that hurts the working class, it doesn't hurt them. And in fact, they'd be perfectly fine with a lot more people out of work, because then once they start rehiring, people are going to be desperate. They can pay them less benefits, all of that. And bear in mind, under the CARES Act, which Trump signed into law in March, expanded unemployment benefits are set to expire by July 31st without additional action from Congress. Oh, and I'm sure that action's coming. I bet Republicans just can't wait to extend those unemployment benefits. And after I acknowledged this on Twitter over the weekend, the thing that has angered the right wing the most since the very beginning of this was when they discovered that some people would temporarily make more money on unemployment than they'd made working. That got them more fired up than anything else since the beginning of this.
No, they hate that. They hate when individuals leech off the system, but if corporations do it,
yeah,
it's all good.
You want to see something that might make you mad, though? This is a Bloomberg tweet. It's to an article, and the tweet is, let me bring this up, Republicans say the U.S. deficit is becoming problematic. But then even better, down below, it's GOP rekindles deficit concerns, adding snag to talks on aid.
Eat
it's like
a
an old
pen
flame.
15.
What's that?
I said eat a pen 15.
Exactly. They talk about it as if, you know, during lockdown, they just started texting again with their old flame concern for the deficit. And you know, maybe things will get going again, you know, probably around November, like especially if Biden wins, maybe we can get something going with this caring about the deficit and the national debt thing. That's what the Republican Party thinks.
Oh, no,
really.
No, they don't ever get to talk about the deficit ever again, because again, actually in the CARES Act, I believe the first round, right, there was a loophole for millionaires so that they're actually getting tax write-offs right now. And they're, again, this is not made up. They're making more money than they were before. They're keeping more of their money. So honestly, they never get to talk about the deficit. Kudlow doesn't care if we all die. He doesn't. That's his whole ideology. When the Fukushima Daiichi plant was, you know, took on water from the tsunami in Japan, Kudlow says, well, the loss of life has been bad, but thank God the market loss isn't that bad.
Ugh.
Yeah, straight up said that on Fox News. He also wrote a whole op-ed right before 2003, I believe, before the U.S. invaded Iraq, saying that we should invade Iraq for the stock market. I mean, everyone was saying we need oil, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, they had the decency to, you know, cover it up with, you know, you got to topple a dictator and weapons of mass destruction. No, no, Kudlow just went right to it. These are the people who are advising this president. Like, there are no more dirtbags left.
Well, I'm so glad that you threw back to that. It's sort of similar, but I think it was Wilbur Ross. Like, as, you know, Asia was getting decimated by coronavirus and it hadn't yet come here, at least we didn't know about it because we weren't testing. He said, well, you know, one of the side effects is that some of the jobs will come back to America. Yeah, it did turn out to be a great stimulus for job creation in the end. These are the best economic minds that they have.
Wilbur Ross, who, what was it? He couldn't believe that people couldn't survive on $7.25 an hour. What was that brilliant gem of a quote he had?
I find that very easy to believe. One of the few times during this pandemic that Donald Trump has invoked the Defense Production Act was to force meatpacking plants to stay operational, to stop the supply chain from breaking down and making it so that people temporarily can't get access to meat. And we have been talking on the Damage Report now for weeks about the very obvious cost of making people go back to work in these places that have already been sites for the spread of coronavirus. We're now finding out that some of them far worse than we thought. More than 1,000 workers at the Tyson Food Plant in Waterloo have tested positive for the coronavirus, more than double the number Governor Kim Reynolds had said the day earlier. The news came as the Arkansas-based company reopened the plant on Thursday after a two-week closure following a spike in COVID-19 cases there. So we thought it was bad. It was actually twice as bad. That's not, I want to be very clear about this, that is not at Tyson Food Plants. That's at one plant. 1,000 cases of coronavirus at one workplace.
How do you protect yourself if 1,000 people in the same plant, like how many people work there?
I think it's several thousand.
Yeah, okay, if there are 1,000 cases, you can bet they're going to be double, triple that, and everyone will have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In very short order. I just want to say on the meatpacking and meat processing plants, it reminds me of that movie Food Inc. from the early 2000s. It was a book, and then it was a movie, and it's a great film. Greg Kinnear, I highly recommend it. The best quote from that entire movie is, I can't say it, but it's basically, there's poop in the meat, Bob, because the thing about meat processing plants, they're already unsanitary to begin with. And coronavirus is just showing us all of the places that we've been ignoring for decades and decades, like nursing homes, like meat processing plants. The conveyor belt moves so fast that when these workers, largely undocumented and immigrant, are pulling out guts, some of the poo gets into the meat. But the conveyor belt is moving so fast that they just have to keep on going. So when you're eating meat, you're eating a little poo.
Yeah. And by the way, if you haven't been following, we've done a couple of videos, both in late fall when these regulation changes were proposed, but also a couple of weeks ago when they were put into effect, that raised the speed of the conveyor belts and took down the number of inspectors who are watching the conveyor belts. They put those into effect during the pandemic, because there was less reason to be worried about contamination of the meat. So 1,000 cases, they shut down the plant for 2 weeks, huge sacrifice, and now they're starting up again. So what are they going to do? Well, Tyson said it's requiring all returning workers as well as new hires to be tested for COVID-19. Employees who have not been tested will be unable to return to work. And we already know in some of these states, if you refuse to return to work because you feel like it is almost a guarantee that you will become exposed to coronavirus, you will lose your job. That's not just a Tyson thing. That's a statewide thing in multiple states. Tyson said it will require employees to wear masks or face shields where protective barriers can't be installed at workstations. In addition to wellness tests before workers start their shifts, Tyson now has an on-site clinic to provide team members with enhanced care, including testing for COVID-19. So that all sounds great. And Tyson wants to assure you that they are taking this seriously. But it wasn't that long ago that they had a very different view of this. And so I saw a write-up in the New York Times of how things worked here in the early stage of this thing, just, you know, a month ago. And take a look at this. So this is after Tony Thompson, who's the Blackhawk County Sheriff, visited that same Waterloo Tyson Food pork plant. This is on April 10th. So just 1 month ago, and this is what they found, workers, many of them immigrants, were crowded elbow to elbow as they broke down hog carcasses zipping by on a conveyor belt. The few who had face coverings were a motley assortment of bandanas, painter's masks, or even sleep masks stretched around their mouths. Sheriff Thompson and other local officials lobbied Tyson to close the plant, but Tyson was, quote, less than cooperative. They sent a text message to their employees 1 week later saying, Waterloo Tyson is running. Thank you, team members. We are proud of you. And within just 5 days, the plant closed. As of Thursday, 1,031 coronavirus infections, more than a third of the workforce, some are on ventilators, three have died, according to Tyson. And perhaps if they had taken it seriously and not tried to keep the hog carcasses zipping by as long as they possibly could, some of those people wouldn't become infected. Some of those people might not have died.
I mean, I think that we know that coronavirus is exposing which bosses and which corporations believe that their workforces are expendable. And I think in industries like agriculture and in meat processing, where it is predominantly done by immigrant workers, some undocumented workers, we know that they are treated based on what they are paid, based on the safety conditions in which they are forced to work, that they're treated like they are expendable. So who cares if they get sick and die? Who cares if they can't afford their health care, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, and I just want to point out also, Tyson has a history of collaborating with ICE, working very closely with ICE. Now, they've been working since 2011, arguably before ICE was like super militarized, of course, although deportations increased under Obama. But remember, a lot of these meat processing plants have been working with ICE to help deport their own workers,
yeah,
and arrest and detain their own workers, knocking on their, you know, the trailers and where they live, waking them at 5 a.m. or earlier than that and hauling them out of their homes because they know where they live, right? Like, this is how they've always treated their workforce. And now we're seeing that, yeah, directly they don't care about their lives.
Exactly. And the I don't know, for any individual person watching this, I am hoping that one of two things will convince you to take this seriously. Either a sense of empathy for the workers at these plants who Tyson's saying they're going to be more watchful for, more protective of, but we know what they were doing just 3 or 4 weeks ago. Either you care about them, or if not for them, like, you don't think that this is going to contribute to the spread of coronavirus? That if hair and nails and feces were getting by before, that you don't think some coronavirus is going to spread? That one plant apparently contributes 4% of the total pork being sent around the country. All over the country, by the way. You don't think that they're going to miss some? Oh, God. They're moving the lines faster. They've cut the number of inspectors into one third of what it once was. This is a recipe for basically a hog filled with poop, metaphorically and literally.
Yeah, and like, let's remember, like, we should not have some empathy or sympathy for these meat processing plants and corporations like Tyson, right? Like, when it comes to actual farmers, when it comes to people raising, you know, pigs, like, sustainably, et cetera, like, that's very, very different than what this is. These guys have been leeching off of this system for a very long time. They have gotten handouts before. They have huge lobbies in Washington. And they, you know, argue, of course, that, like, if we don't get subsidies, then Chinese products will come in and, like, kick us out. Well, the entire meat trade, honestly, is really messed up. Like, it's disgusting. It's gross. Factory farming is disgusting. Factory meat processing is disgusting. I mean, once again, coronavirus is just that little introspective moment for us to look at how we do things and how we should be changing for the better.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I had said weeks ago, like, I understand some of these meat alternatives, still the price needs to get down a little bit. And they're not necessarily perfect for you health-wise in comparison to actual all natural, you know, vegetables and all that. But a lot of them are very competitive substitutes for meat. And, you know, for all of the obvious reasons that have been known for a long time, it's a good alternative. And now for this as well, hypothetically, might keep you safe as well. So consider it. If you haven't had an Impossible Burger or Beyond Sausage or something like that, just consider it. For some of these,
okay,
a lot of the meat that Americans eat is barely meat anyway. How much meat do you think is in a chicken nugget? It's trace amounts at best. So just take out the last bit.
Trump is so wedded to, like, the meat industry. I feel like he's just ultimately afraid, like, is the Big Mac going away? How's the Big Mac? You know, he's like, how's every day he gets, like, a Big Mac report. And he just wants to make sure that the disgusting beef that is in the Big Mac that is like, you know, tinged. The reason it's delicious is because of the science behind it, right? And the little like whatever taste nodes. That's what I'm going to call them.
Yeah, they pack more taste nodes in than other countries have been able to so far. Mm.
But all you guys like is pink slime. I'm sorry. Don't at me. But y'all just like pink slime. Go eat pink slime. They should just sell the pink slime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fake chicken nuggets. It's the same. It might literally be the same thing. Would you be surprised to find out it was actually the same thing and that there was no chicken in either? Over the weekend, there were multiple important updates on the case of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. I want to update you on just one or two that I think are particularly important. First has to do with another video that has been released that bears on the case. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution published surveillance footage on Saturday that shows a figure entering a house under construction that day shortly before the shooting, lingering for a few minutes, and then jogging toward the location where the three men later confronted Ahmaud Arbery. And, you know, when that video came out that showed that he had walked, someone, we don't know for sure, it's believed that it was possibly him, had walked into this building under construction, looked around for a couple of minutes, and then left. It is amazing the extent to which that seemed to, for many on the right, confirm, oh yeah, no, his murder was totally justified. And that is what I saw from them. For reasonable people, I saw a lot of people responding with, yeah, I've looked at buildings under construction. I've poked my head in. When I was a kid, we used to sneak into abandoned houses and houses that were being built. It was cool. That's what we used to do. I was never murdered over it. If I had been, it would have been considered a tragedy by everyone. For some reason, this one isn't. But anyway, we have a little bit more on this. But Francesca, what do you think about the new video that was released?
Yeah, I mean, it's, once again, it's just jogging while black. It's doing anything that if you were not a black person in America, you would not be brutalized. You would not, no one would think anything of it. No one would, you know, you can't even go into a market without being followed around, or a retail store without being followed around in this country. You can't play loud music. You can't, it's just add to the list. Mm-hmm. And like half the reason people walk around neighborhoods is to look at the construction building. I want to look at homes. I want to see what are they building? Ooh, wow. Ooh, like that's very, very normal. And it's all just an excuse. It's total BS. Like, obviously, I think if it means nothing. Oh, so there was a surveillance video of maybe him looking at a construction site. Who cares? He should have never been killed.
Uh-huh. 100%. It shows no illegal activity. And again, as I've said from the beginning, even if it did, it would not justify a couple of whack jobs driving out and murdering someone. So really fast, I want to give you a statement from, this is Lee Merritt, Arbery family attorney, put out a statement after the video came out saying he engaged in no legal activity and remained for only a brief period. Ahmaud did not take anything from the construction site. He did not cause any damage to the property. And importantly, Larry English, the man who owns the house under construction, told the Washington Post that the structure was not robbed. And he went on to say, it's completely wrong. I've never had a police report or anything stolen from my property or any kind of robbery. And he went on to say, I don't think anyone should ever have to lose a child. It's not supposed to be that way. And he, felt for the family for what ended up happening and doesn't like being used by the right wing in its attempt to once again justify the unjustifiable.
I wonder if they'll reach out for an interview with him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Breitbart is really, they really want his opinion. When the first video was released last week, I forget exactly who was on. It might have been M at the time. But we said, it seems impossible. Like, you're looking at the video. How could they do the thing that they always do? Are they going to go back through his Facebook page when he was in high school or something? Are they going to, all that? And they have. And the thing is, they will say till their last day that they're not racist and that indeed racism doesn't exist in America. But then why are we always able to predict exactly how they're going to react? Why is it that it's not like some of them are defending the vigilantes? All of them are, as predicted. Why are all of them always on the side of the white guy who kills the black guy? Why should it be so predictable? If it's not a racial thing, as they will say that it's not,
yes,
how do we always know?
And I think that the other thing here is that they're going to talk about how he tried to fight back. when he was being aggressed upon by two, maybe three people in two pickup trucks while he was on a jog, who were toting guns and firing at him. He fought back. Well, guess what? Black people are human people too. We all react the same. Like, holy sh— I can't, I'm so angry right now. Like you react as any person would react. And if someone is charging at you, or in Trayvon Martin's case, when someone is tackling you and following you, you're going to get angry. You have every right to respond. Yeah. All right. And so they're going to use that against him. And it makes me so angry because, once again, you're dehumanizing African Americans in this country. You're criminalizing blackness. And I just, like, when is it enough?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. If two people jump out of a car pointing guns at you, if there's enough distance, maybe you try running away. If they're close to you, you have to try to grab the gun. Because, like, this is the thing that they don't seem to, that they either can't understand, or at least will say that they can't understand. When these two sorts of guys jump out of a car pointing guns at you, the first thought that a rational human is not, oh, these are upstanding citizens who want to conduct a citizen's arrest. They're just concerned about law and order in the area. That's why they grabbed shotguns and jumped in their pickup truck. No, reasonable people think, oh, these are crazies who believe that they should have godlike powers over life and death, which they definitely wanted to have. That's why they did this. And so you have to protect yourself, obviously. Yep. And the idea that, like they said, like, he once tried to bring a gun into school or something like that. Like, I don't even know if that's true. I don't think they care if it's true. But that would be a justification for years later, two other people who don't know about that killing them. Okay, I just saw this morning footage of a bunch of guys at lockdown protests going to a subway carrying shotguns, assault rifles. One guy had, like, an inert rocket launcher. Okay, so if in 8 years anyone murders those guys, it's justified because they once brought a gun into a place. Does anyone think that? What a weird exercise to engage in, to continually defend the most brutal, indefensible murderers in the country. That's yep. your thing, that's your grift. But for many, it is. We are joined now on the program by both one of the founders of the Green Party and also the front runner in the Green Party's quest to choose a presidential candidate, Howie Hawkins. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Well, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. Excited to learn more about your platform. And obviously, you have a long history with the Green Party. What would you say about the current place of the Green Party in this election? You know, we went through the 2016 experience. How is the party reacting to both the pandemic, the current, what look like the likely nominees from the Democratic and the Republican Party?
Well, the president is totally incompetent. It's a total disaster. And Biden is invisible. And a lot of people got behind Bernie Sanders, but Biden is opposed to what he stood for. So a lot of those people are coming our way. So I think there's a big opportunity for us to put our green solutions into the national debate and really change the direction of the country.
Okay, and what would you say are some of the biggest policy distinctions between you and what are looking like Biden and Trump as the candidates for the Democratic and Republican parties?
Well, I lead with three life or death issues. One, of course, is the climate crisis. And we have an eco-socialist Green New Deal proposal. I was the first candidate in this country to campaign on a Green New Deal in 2010. And that addresses the climate crisis. We want to get to 100% clean energy and zero to negative carbon emissions by 2030, because that is what the climate science carbon budgets say rich countries like the United States need to do if we're going to avoid the worst of this climate calamity. And then, as part of the Green New Deal, we've always had an economic bill of rights, because inequality is a life or death issue. Working class life expectancies are declining in this country. And so the economic bill of rights is about ending poverty and economic despair. It includes the right to a job, an income above poverty, affordable housing, comprehensive health care, lifelong public education, and a secure retirement. And then the third issue is this new nuclear arms race, which none of the presidential candidates are talking about. But we're in a real crisis here. The U.S. has been modernizing its forces, and Russia and China and other countries have responded. Tactical nukes in conventional forces, with the crazy idea that they can escalate to de-escalate. In other words, you use tactical nukes if you're losing a conventional war, and then you de-escalate. But we know from Daniel Ellsberg, who was a nuclear war planner before he was a Vietnam War planner, that once the nukes start flying, it's automated. They all fly and we're over. So we're calling for nuclear disarmament initiatives and going to the other nuclear powers and saying, let's have complete and mutual nuclear disarmament. So those are, you know, three of the leading issues that I've been emphasizing.
So why don't we start off with the first around the Green New Deal? So over the past couple of years, we've heard quite a bit about it. There's a framework that has been championed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. During the Democratic presidential primary, virtually all of the candidates said that they supported a Green New Deal, although they weren't always very specific about what that term meant to them. So when you talk about a Green New Deal, what are some of the differences between what you see it encompassing and the current version that some parts of the Democratic Party are supporting?
Well, the Green New Deal was the signature issue for the Green Party for the last decade. I ran on it in 2010. By the end of the campaign, we had 62 Greens around the country campaigning on it. Our presidential candidate, Jill Stein, a Green New Deal for America was the theme of both her 2012 and 2016 campaigns for president. And then when AOC and Ed Markey took their non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal to Congress, they took the brand and diluted the content. They eliminated the ban on fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure. We got to stop that or we're going to be locked into decades more burning fossil fuels. They eliminated the deep cuts in military spending to help fund the Green New Deal. And they extended the deadline from 2030 to 2050. So what we're talking about is it's too late to use market incentives. We got to do it through the public sector like we did during World War II emergency when the federal government took over or built a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country in order to turn industry on a dime into what they called the arsenal of democracy to arm the U.S., the U.K., and Russia to defeat the Nazis. We need to do nothing less to defeat climate change. So we need a public energy system, public transportation system to rebuild the rails and integrate the airlines into that. And then we got to go into manufacturing. We need all new production systems that are based on clean energy and zero waste. And, you know, that's from agriculture to manufacturing steel. So it's a huge job. And none of the Democrats were serious except Bernie Sanders. He was on a little bit slower timeline. He was going to spend $16.3 trillion over 10 years. Our budget says $27 trillion over 10 years to get to 100% clean energy. He extended the deadline on agriculture, manufacturing, and buildings to 2050. But that's half the carbon footprint right there. We can't wait on that. So I think those are some of the distinctions. And the fact is the Democrats aren't going to give us a Green New Deal. Pelosi won't let them vote on that non-binding resolution. And when they voted in the Senate, the Democrats voted present, except four of them voted with the Republicans no. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need to be in this race.
Do you think that the experience that we've had over the past few months with the government response to the pandemic, where, you know, governors have ordered lockdowns, there's been these big changes to the way people run their daily life. The president has invoked the Defense Production Act to, for instance, keep, you know, meatpacking plants open. Do you think that this sort of experience that people have been through might have prepped them, perhaps, for some of the changes that will need to take place for us to address the climate crisis?
Yeah, it's been such a total disaster. And I think people want the federal government to step on the coronavirus crisis. And in fact, I think to get us out of this coronavirus depression we're now plunging into, we're going to need to have this public investment in a Green New Deal to get us out of it. I mean, right now, investors are scared. They're not going to make new productive investments. Consumers, they're running out of money, so they're going to hoard what they don't have to spend for basic needs. The economy is going to be stagnated coming out of this unless we have a big public investment in new productive assets that creates lots of jobs. I mean, when we finished our budget, it was 38 million jobs, and we did it in the fall, and we're saying the bottleneck is labor to get all the people we need in construction and manufacturing and so forth to do this. Mm-hmm. Of course, now, if you look at the extended unemployment figures, 43 million, if you look at the National Jobs for All Coalition calculation of not just those officially unemployed, but the hidden unemployment, discouraged workers, and people working part-time that want to work full-time. So now we can put those people to work and get out of this depression.
You know, and obviously that would have a big impact on, you know, one big part of the pandemic is the economic damage. Specific to the spread of the virus, if you were in charge right now, what are some changes you would make to the White House's response to the spread of coronavirus?
I would use the Defense Production Act to line up the supply chain, first of all, for the medical supplies And secondly, for the testing, contact tracing, and quarantining, because that's what we need to be able to safely go back to work. And it's not being done. I mean, Cuomo's got the states bidding against each other for supplies, tests, the whole deal. And his international policy as well. He's got us, you know, the world should be cooperating. On Friday, the U.S. vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution for a global ceasefire so we can cooperate and coordinate in fighting this global pandemic. I mean, Trump has been a total disaster. He's killing us.
Yeah. And when we've known it in a lot of different areas, he's used the sort of cover that this pandemic is providing to ram through changes to the EPA, change regulations in food production and things like that. Are you worried that we might see more of that in the area of foreign policy, that some of these conflicts that he's obviously been lusting for some time, that he might pursue those while people are focused on domestic concerns?
I think we saw that last week when those mercenaries, who I don't believe U.S. intelligence forces didn't know exactly what they were trying to do, tried to stage a coup in Venezuela. I mean, it was pretty pathetic. I'm a former Marine, man. I wouldn't have been wanted to have been on their mission. And they got caught. And, you know, we know that at least one of the, what was he? He said he was a DEA agent, said, you know, Trump knew about all this. So, yeah, they're going to use the coronavirus as a cover for all kinds of nefarious things.
Well, and we know that Mike Pompeo said that the U.S. was not directly involved, which was an interesting way to put it, rather than just saying not involved.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, yeah.
So another issue that's cropped up recently over the past few weeks in your presidential campaign was I know that you had a bit of an issue with Twitter seemingly targeting some of your accounts. It looks like that's mostly been restored, right? But did you ever get an answer as to why Twitter seemed to be targeting your campaign on social media?
Well, their explanation, I mean, they never contacted me. They said I was impersonating myself, and I don't even know how you do that. So, you know, my campaign account, when I looked at, there was a link they left to file complaints, and I looked at it. Somebody could have done a dirty trick on us and said that they could have said they were me and that this site is impersonating me. But I never did that. Mm-hmm. So there got some publicity in the media, and then we got a cryptic two-sentence response that your site will be back up in an hour. No explanation. And we never talked to any of them. It just signs that both messages signed off, thanks, Twitter. It's bizarre.
Yeah, and probably I would be worried that if it could end without any explanation, it could conceivably happen again without an explanation. So hopefully you can avoid that. I know that in the last week or so, you also chose a running mate. Could you tell us a little bit about your running mate?
Yeah, her name's Angela Walker. People may know her as the independent socialist that ran against David Clark, that cowboy hat-wearing crazy sheriff of Milwaukee County. And nobody's running against her. So she stepped up back in 2016. Basically, her program was, you know, fight crime by fighting poverty. And David Clark's way of dealing with crime was, he said, don't call 911, get a gun. So, you know, I knew her from then. We were on a panel together. And then we were on a panel the next year, and I followed her. The Socialist Party ran her as a vice presidential candidate in 2016. So she's somebody that I have a rapport with. She knows the issues, and she speaks in a way that people can understand what she's talking about and believe, you know, her conviction and feel it. So I, all along, when we thought about who might be a running mate, she was always at the top of my list, and I'm just really happy she said yes.
Okay, well, perhaps we'll have an opportunity to talk to her at some point in the near future as well. In the meantime, where can people find out more about your candidacy, your platform, all of that?
Go to the website for the campaign. It's howiehawkins.us. HOWIEHAWKINS.US, like the United States or like us.
Mr. Hawkins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.